This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is lecture 19, given in Dornach on April 8, 1920. I will attempt to elaborate as much as possible today and tomorrow. In the case of a very preliminary stimulus such as this, which was all this course could provide, the important concern is to become more familiar with how spiritual science describes the route by which outer substances enter the human organism, and also with the counter effects of these substances. Having a complete overview of how any substance takes effect points the way to discovering its use as a remedy, and we can then judge for ourselves which is much better than simply following guidelines stating that this is for this and that for that. Today I will once again have to begin with a topic seemingly very far removed in order to arrive at something very close at hand. One question that appeared repeatedly, a question that necessarily interests all of you, is the question of heredity. It plays an exceptionally large role in assessing both the healthy, or at least relatively healthy, individual, and the sick individual. It must be said that modern materialistic science studies heredity only on a very abstract level, without many practical consequences for real life. Strangely enough, or at least exotericists find this strange, because to esotericists its laws are readily apparent, when we begin to study a subject like heredity seriously, we find that everything that is important for people to know about cosmic connections is outwardly revealed and quite visible at some point or other. In each instance, an outer manifestation of some sort reveals the forces that are present in external nature, but hidden, although very active, in the human being. We must keep these forces particularly in mind as we study heredity, because everything related to heredity is constantly being negatively influenced and veiled in illusions so that we cannot assess it properly. Having arrived at a conclusion about heredity, we find that it does not concur with other phenomena. This is because the facts of heredity in particular are so shrouded in illusions, which in turn is related to the fact that male and female are involved in heredity in ways that are very lawfully governed, but are difficult to determine. Heredity is indeed governed by laws, but the manifestations of these laws are such that their regulating principles cannot always be apparent immediately. The horizontal position of the beam of a scale is governed by laws, but if we keep adding weight so that it tilts to the right or to the left, it is difficult to adhere strictly to the principle. Something similar is true of hereditary phenomena. Their governing principle is akin to the forces that bring the beam of a scale into horizontal position. As it manifests, however, this lawfulness is extremely variable, because male and female are always involved in specific ways in heredity. The male always transmits what human beings owe to earthly existence and earthly forces, while the female organism is more oriented toward transmitting what comes from the supra-earthly cosmos. We might say that the earth constantly makes demands on the man, organizing him through its forces, and that it is also the root of the development of male sexuality. In contrast, the heavens are constantly making demands on the woman and bringing about her form. Their influence predominates in all of her internal organizational processes. This distinction points back to something I have already said. If conception results in a female being, she tends to be taken up by the heavens, if I may put it like that, to become ever more incorporated into supra-earthly processes, while a male being tends to be claimed by the earth to an ever-increasing extent. Thus the earth and the heavens work together, because what I am saying should not be interpreted as meaning that only the heavens work on the female and only the earth works on the male. Both influence both, but the balance tilts toward the side of the heavens in the woman and toward the side of the earth in the man. The laws governing this balance, although very strict, are also variable. This variability has certain consequences, however. There is something intrinsic to the woman's organism that continually resists earthly factors. But, strangely enough, this is the case only within her own organism, and does not apply to the embryo she carries. In the female organism, the heaven's struggle against the earth is restricted to all the organizational processes that lie outside the formation of the ovum, that is, outside of what is incorporated into the reproductive processes. This means that the female organization is always withdrawing from the forces inherent in the reproductive process. In the woman, everything surrounding reproduction withdraws from these forces. We can say that while the man has some tendency to pass on all that is inherent in the reproductive forces, that is, everything that can be passed down via heredity, the woman, although she tends to withdraw from heredity herself, has a stronger tendency to transmit hereditary characteristics through her egg-forming forces. For this reason, we can ask the question, how can we work within human society to counteract destructive forces of heredity? It is indeed true that the forces of heredity do not come to a halt in the face of either so-called spiritual or so-called physical factors. This is apparent, for example, in the fact that diabetes can very easily appear in the next generation of a family that tends heavily towards psychiatric illnesses in the present generation, so that a metamorphosis in direction occurs between generations. How to rescue people from destructive effects of heredity is indeed an exceptionally important question. The only way to do so is to make sure that womankind remains as healthy as possible, because healthy women will draw supra-earthly influences into our earthly processes. And as a result, the processes that work to transmit hereditary damage by means of the embryo will be constantly combated from within the female organism. Therefore, a society that pays close attention to women's health resists the damaging influence of earthly forces on heredity by appealing to the effects of balancing forces that work in from above the earth. The female organization acts as the only earthly accumulator of these forces. It is extremely important to take this into account. What I have just said is universal. It applies to all earthly and supra-earthly forces. It becomes very visible, however, when we are dealing with hemophilia, with blood diseases. It is important to point out the fallacy of talking around the subject of hereditary phenomena in general terms. We must study those instances where the facts obviously point to the hereditary. Please study the manifestations of heredity in hemophiliacs. You will discover a strange phenomenon that is familiar to all of you, but which is only an outer expression of what I have just explained. You will find that in the bloodline of a family, hemophilia is transmitted only to male individuals by female individuals. That is, a woman who is the daughter of a hemophiliac tends to transmit the disease to her male offspring, even though she herself does not have it. She simply carries it because she belongs to that family. The men, in contrast, become hemophiliacs. but if they marry women who can be proved not to come from hemophiliac families, their disease is not transmitted. If you analyze this tendency, you will find it to be a clear manifestation of what I have just said. The phenomena among hemophiliacs demonstrate the actual processes of heredity much more clearly than any of Weismann's recent experiments. Footnote: August Weismann, 1834-1914, first a physician, then professor of zoology in Freiburg. He postulated that acquired characteristics cannot be inherited. His book is Die Kontinuität der Keimplasmas als Grundlage einer Theorie der Vererbung, 1885. The continuity of germ plasma is the basis of the theory of heredity. End of footnote. We must also regard these circumstances as important to an overall assessment of the human organization, which needs to be assessed in accordance with what can influence it. What is the real basis of hemophilia? Even superficial consideration reveals the answer. The clotting ability of the blood is absent, so that even the slightest opening toward the outside can make a hemophiliac bleed to death. As a rule, clotting sets in at the wound site after a nosebleed or a dental operation, for example. But in hemophiliacs, this does not happen. All their symptoms are entirely due to deficient clotting ability. There must be a factor in their blood that counteracts clotting and works too strongly, so that it is not negated by the forces that begin to work in from outside when blood clots. When blood clots, we are dealing with forces that work in from the outer world. If there is something inherent in the blood that does not allow these forces to prevail, the blood tends to be too fluid. You will easily discover that a strong tendency toward excessively fluid blood is related to the entire development of the human eye, capital, but not in a superficially apparent way. It is related not to the ideational process, but to the will that is active in the human eye. Thus, the organization that causes excessive fluidity in the blood is associated with everything that strengthens or weakens a person's will. Let me give you a nice historical example that once again demonstrates that we can discover certain secrets of nature if we interpret them correctly. It was not nature alone, however, but history that presented the famous case of the young women of Engadin, which you may have heard of. Footnote: there is no documentation of any such case as Engadin, E-N-G-A-D-I-N. The incident referred to may well have occurred in Tenna, in the Safin Valley, which, like Engadin, is also in Graubünden. See the novel by Ernst Zahn, Die Frauen von Tanno, The Women of Tanno. Tanno is a poetic variation on the name Tenna. End of footnote. These two young women represent a phenomenon that can thoroughly illuminate the understanding of the human being that medicine needs. These young women, who came from hemophiliac families, made a firm decision not to marry. They went down in history as personal opponents of the transmission of hemophilia. We must make sure that we are looking at the right place in such a case. It is certainly not characteristic of all young women from hemophiliac families to abstain from the urge to reproduce. Doing so requires the cultivation of a strong subjective will of the sort that works in the eye rather than in the astral body. This strong will must have been present in these two young women, which means that what they had in their eye, in their will, was in some way related to the forces that are active in hemophiliacs in particular. Consciously strengthening these forces is easier among hemophiliacs than among non-hemophiliacs. If this fact is acknowledged in the right way, it provides a certain insight into the blood's intrinsic forces and enables us to recognize their interaction with what lies outside the human being. By studying the forces in the blood that are related to conscious will, we discover the nature of the human will's entire relationship to forces outside the human being. The fact of the matter is that certain external forces have this particular inner relationship to human forces of will, because the last thing expelled into the natural world in the course of evolution had to do with conscious human will, or with human will in general. This was the last thing to be forced out into the natural world. It is important to study such processes, which shaped the human being, but have been forced out and are now present in external nature. These excluded processes have intrinsic qualities that show how they relate to the process of shaping the human being. One such phenomenon has been studied for a long time. It is extremely difficult to get an overview of it, because modern intellectual people have difficulty re-enlivening the forces that preserved atavistic medicine even into the 17th and 18th centuries. This phenomenon that has been studied for so long is antimony and everything related to it. Antimony, you see, is a very strange material, which is probably why some people who dealt with it, such as the legendary Basilius Valentinus, studied it so intensively. Footnote: it is said that Basilius Valentinus, Basil Valentine, lived at about the end of the 14th and the beginning of the 15th century. Writings attributed to him include the Tract of the Great Stone, Concerning Natural and Supernatural Things, and the Triumphal Chariot of Antimony. End of footnote. Certain characteristics of antimony immediately reveal that it is very strangely enmeshed in the processes of nature. Possibly one of the least of antimony's characteristics is that it has an exceptional relationship to other metals and other substances, frequently appearing in conjunction with them, especially in other substances, sulfur compounds. In the natural world, sulfur, as you know, has a specific effect that we have discussed, at least briefly. Antimony's affinity for the sulfur compounds of other substances demonstrates how it is enmeshed in nature. This is even more emphatically evident, however, in another of its characteristics, namely that whenever the opportunity arises, antimony appears in the form of bundle-like crystals. That is, it wants to turn into a line and move away from the earth. Wherever antimony accumulates in linear formations, we can literally see the supra-earthly forces of crystallization entering the earthly domain. Crystal-forming forces that otherwise appear in more regular forms are active in these bundled, needle-like antimony formations. The substance of antimony itself reveals how it is enmeshed in the overall activity of nature. Similarly, the smelting process that yields antimony in the form of fine filaments points very strongly to antimony as a revealer of crystallization forces. Another quality of antimony is that it can oxidize and even burn in a certain way if it is heated until red hot. The white smoke that forms has an affinity for cold objects to which it adheres, producing the well-known, quote, flowers of antimony, close quote. Footnote: flowers of antimony is the white smoke from an alchemical fusion process that produces antimony. Basil Valentine stated, quote, the flowers of antimony may be prepared in different ways, which all students of alchemy know. Some mix them with salt, ammonia, drive them through the retort, and then wash out the ammonia. These flowers are of a beautiful white color. Others sublime them over a strong fire, and by placing three alembics on each other, they manage to prepare white, yellow, and red flowers at the same time. But the most potent and efficacious flowers of antimony are prepared as follows. Mix red flowers of antimony with coal catar of vitriol and sublime the mixture thrice. Then the essence of vitriol ascends with the flowers, and they become more effectual. Extract the flowers with spirit of wine, remove sediment, distill spirit of wine in bath of St. Mary, till there remains a dry powder, which represents the purified flowers of antimony. These flowers act as a gentle purgative, They cure tertian and quartan fever and most other diseases. Close quote from The Triumphal Chariot of Antimony, Vincent Stuart Publishers, London, 1962, pages 122 to 124. End of footnote. Again, this is an example of how the force of crystallization is discharged in conjunction with other bodies. The strangest characteristic of antimony, however, is its ability to ward off certain forces that I have described over the course of the days we have spent here as being sub-earthly in some respects. These are the forces at work in electricity and magnetism. If antimony is subjected to a specific type of electrolysis that makes it precipitate at the cathode, and if this antimony deposit is then touched with the tip of a metal rod, the antimony explodes. It creates little explosions. The resistance to electricity that antimony develops, if we simply give it a bit of help, is quite characteristic of this substance. Here we can see how antimony fits into the context of nature. Other substances do not demonstrate their place in nature so forcefully. We can understand what an obvious natural example is attempting to show us only when we assume that the forces present in nature are at work everywhere, but are simply exceptionally evident in substances where they are concentrated and localized. The force working in antimony, for example, is actually present everywhere. To coin a phrase, the antimonizing force is at work everywhere. This antimonizing force also has a regulating function within the human being. But human beings, in normal health, draw this force in from outside the earth. In a normal state of health, we turn not to the antimonizing force in the earthly element, or to its concentrated form in the substance antimony, but to the external, supra-earthly force of antimony. The obvious question is, what is this antimonizing force in the supra-earthly domain? From the planetary perspective, it is the interaction of Mercury, Venus, and the Moon. When these planets work together, rather than separately, their effects are not mercurial, silvery, or coppery. Instead, they work just as antimony works in the Earth. This effect can be investigated simply by looking for the effects on human beings of constellations in which the three forces of the Moon, Mercury, and Venus neutralize each other through the appropriate oppositions and quadratures. When they work together in this way, their interaction is related to the effect of earthly antimony. The force that works out of the earth from all of its antimony is the same as the force that works down on the earth from these three planetary bodies above the earth. This leads me to mention another point. You see, the makeup of the earth is such that it is actually incorrect to speak of an individual piece of antimony. All of the antimony within the earth's organization forms a unity, as does all of the silver or all of the gold. The individual piece is not very important. If you take a bit of antimony out of the earth, you are simply rummaging around in the antimony body that is incorporated into the earth. The bit belongs to the entire antimony body. Having said this, we have described one aspect of what becomes visible through the effects of antimony. In nature, however, any effect is always opposed by a counter-effect, and objects are given form through the alternation between effect and counter-effect. Now, we need to look for the opposing forces. They reveal themselves as soon as we recognize that antimony forces are acting on the human being whenever anything regulated in the interior pushes its way outward. These same antimony forces are at work in the clotting of blood. This is where the antimonizing factor is active. Wherever the blood shows a tendency to pause and clot in its ongoing existence and flow, the antimonizing force is present. Wherever the blood attempts to evade the force of clotting, the opposite effects are present. As curious as it may seem, we always encounter anti-antimony forces in hemophiliacs. We find these anti-antimonizing forces in them. These forces, however, are identical to what I would like to call the proteinizing forces, if you will, the forces that form protein, whose organizing effect promotes protein formation. I repeat, the protein-forming forces are what prevents blood from clotting. In this way, we develop a knowledge of the connection between antimonizing and proteinizing factors in the human organism. I must say, I believe that studying the interaction between these factors would yield fundamental insights into disease processes and healing processes, because proteinizing activity takes all the forces that sculpt and shape in the natural world and incorporates them into the human or animal organism for purposes of building up substance. Antimonizing forces are the sculptors, as it were, that work inward from the outside to give shape to the substances that build up our organs. Thus the forces of antimony have a certain relationship to our organs' internal organizing forces. It is important to distinguish between these two processes when you consider the internal structure of an organ such as the esophagus. You can trace its internal structure in a certain way without first taking into account the type of process that takes place there, how semi-liquefied food moves along the esophagus, and so on. Along comes the esophagus and works together with what is entering the human organism. On an abstract level, we can separate the processes taking place in an organ's internal structure and what happens when the organ works together with what enters the human being from outside. These are two different processes. In the organ itself, the antimonizing force is at work in the human being. The human being is antimony if we exclude from consideration everything that is introduced from outside. The human being is antimony. The important thing is not to overburden the normal, vital, internal, organ-forming force with this antimony-forming force. We must not introduce it into life's normal processes, or we will poison the organism through over-stimulation. When it needs stimulating more strongly, however, we must administer something that we ordinarily should not. At this point, you turn to the effect of antimony, which results from the qualities of antimony that I described earlier. This effect varies in specific ways, depending on whether you apply the antimony externally or internally. When you administer antimony internally, you must try to use such a high dilution that it can penetrate into the upper part of the human being. If you are successful, this will have an exceptionally strong stimulating effect on disturbances in organ development or internal organ processes. For this reason, highly potentized antimony will play a major role in certain forms of typhoid fever. In contrast, when antimony is applied externally, in the form of ointments and the like, the effect is somewhat different and is achieved by using lower potencies. Under certain circumstances, of course, we may also need to appeal to the power of more highly potentized antimony for the sake of external parts of the body. In general, however, its external effects are induced by using lower potencies. This example demonstrates that an exceptionally useful therapeutic substance such as antimony is interposed into what I described as a lawfully regulated course of events oscillating between two poles. For this reason, you will have to restrict the internal use of antimony to patients who are very strong-willed and external applications to individuals who tend to be weak-willed. You will have to make this distinction. As you see, the antimony in the mineral kingdom manifests as something that has an inner relationship to human will. In that, the more conscious human will becomes, the more it feels the need to bring about an effect opposite to that of antimony. Human will has a destructive effect on all the forces that I described earlier as constituting the characteristic action of antimony. In contrast, antimony supports everything that has an organizing effect in the human being and is influenced by thought forces, especially the subconscious thought forces that are still active in children. Antimony's forces work together with these particular forces. Thus, if I introduce antimony into the human organism arbitrarily, and it makes its own forces strongly felt, it develops a powerful phantom within the human being. The inner forces of the organs are immediately stimulated, and nothing is left over to allow them to work together with what has been introduced into the organism. The result is vomiting and diarrhea, which are due to the fact that the action is confined to the organs themselves and does not extend to their surroundings, as the counter-effect also attests. Footnote: critical to understanding this section is the concept of digestion as an external process that moves through the human body, a process that is essentially the same as, though more complex than, the digestive process of a single-celled organism when it secretes enzymes into its environment and absorbs the dissolving nutrients. The human digestive tract may be viewed as surrounding, not containing, the food passing through, which is still quote-unquote outside. This quote-unquote outer, in this case, should not be thought of as outside the body in the usual sense. End of footnote. If your constitution permits, you can counteract the damaging effect of antimony by means of a drug that is the instinctive choice of people who enjoy anything that supports and regulates their circulation and other rhythmical processes. Drinking coffee has a balancing effect on these rhythmical processes. I am simply recounting the facts here. My intention is not to recommend this practice, because in a different connection it can be very harmful to take the regulation of these rhythmical processes away from the I itself. But that is not what I want to talk about here. I simply want to discuss the facts. Drinking coffee brings a certain order into the rhythmical processes when the soul of the person in question is not strong enough to do this itself. This is why coffee is an antidote of sorts to the toxic effects of antimony. Coffee reestablishes the rhythm between the internal action of organs and what lies outside them. This interaction is also maintained by a particular rhythm. The real reason for drinking coffee is to bring about an ongoing rhythmization between our internal organs and what happens to ingested foods in the vicinity of these organs. All of this brings us back to a different activity, namely the proteinizing process. It and all the processes on this other side are strengthened, not the side of the organ's own internal power of organization, but the side where digestion occurs as the result of the organ's outer action. Everything that happens on a mechanical level, in the movement of the intestines, and everything else that takes place in digestion, is in intimate interaction with the proteinizing forces, the forces that build up protein and are the opposite of the antimonizing forces. I must now point again to something I indicated earlier. The oyster, with its shell formation, is a very instructive object, or subject if you prefer. To a lesser extent, the same process is present in the calcium excretions that produce eggshells. What is the basis of this? What is a shell, such as an oyster shell or an ordinary eggshell? It is a product that the egg or oyster tissue has to get rid of by forcing it to the outside, since its continued internal presence would kill the egg or the oyster. the development of such a shell is based simply on the need to maintain life. If we eat oysters, we are also eating the life process that manifests in external shell formation. I can put this to you in these terms, I hope, although I would have to speak somewhat more selectively if I wanted to please modern science. In any case, along with the oyster, we eat this life process, a proteinizing activity that opposes the antimonizing process. By doing this, we promote everything in the human being that leads to the development of typhoid systems. Eating oysters is an exceptionally interesting practice. It promotes the formative force, the proteinizing force, in the human abdomen. By doing so, however, it frees the head of certain forces, removes them from the head. As a result, someone who has eaten oysters feels less weighed down by the forces that want to work in the head. In a certain respect, eating oysters makes the head empty. We must develop these proteinizing forces constantly, because we cannot allow the head to be burdened with form-giving forces. People who eat oysters, however, take this too far, striving passionately toward empty-headedness and also increasing the possibility that certain forces will break through in the direction of the abdominal organs, as I described yesterday. That is, the tendency to typhoid fever is encouraged. You can imagine how this tendency, if present, calls for treatment with antimony. We will be able to successfully summon up what is needed to internally combat the tendency to typhoid fever by implementing simultaneous internal and external treatment with antimony, especially by rubbing in antimony ointments while administering high potencies of antimony internally. This therapy would work from both sides to counteract the tendency toward typhoid. You see how we always attempt to consider the human being in the context of the cosmic environment. The significance of this view becomes apparent when you investigate the human being's connection to what happens in the natural world, when the direct forces of the earth are opposed in a particular way. Plants are able to resist the direct forces of the earth and to save up many of their formative forces for the time when flowers and seeds develop. The usual process of plant formation that underlies edible plants is based on the use of a very specific total amount of earthly forces in building up the plant. If a plant resists these earthly forces, it is exposed to supra-earthly forces as it approaches its culmination in the development of seeds and fruits, and it then begins to want to look out into the world in the same way as higher beings. This plant is greedy to perceive, but has no organs to support perception. It remains a plant, but it wants to develop an organ similar to the human eye, EYE. It cannot develop an eye, however, because it has the body of a plant rather than that of a human or an animal. As a result, this plant develops into deadly nightshade, Atropa belladonna. I have tried to vividly describe the process that takes place in the development of deadly nightshade. Because it evolves into deadly nightshade, and because the forces with which it ultimately imbues its black berries are already present in its roots, this plant is related to everything in the human organism that moves in the direction of the type of form development that can happen only in the domain of the senses, to something that lifts human beings out of the domain of their internal organization and into the domain of their senses. The process that takes place when tiny potentized amounts of deadly nightshade are ingested is extremely interesting, because it is very similar to the normal version of this same process, namely the waking up process that is mingled with dreaming. Waking up, the state when we are still not quite perceiving with our senses and sensory perception, is still directed inward, pervading our consciousness with dreams, is a type of deadly nightshade process within the human being. Deadly nightshade toxin evokes the same activity that otherwise takes place when our waking is pervaded with dreams, but makes it permanent. In nightshade poisoning, this process is not subsumed by consciousness, and the transitional phenomena persist. We see an interesting circumstance here. If evoked at the right times, processes that may also be symptomatic of poisoning are quite at home in the human organization. As I just described, the development of deadly nightshade is a plant's mad desire to become human. We might say that human waking has something of the character of this process of developing into nightshade, but it is toned down, kept within limits, and restricted to the moment of awakening. Thus, if you want to relieve the body of inner proteinizing processes, to make excessively strong proteinizing processes withdraw, and to deflect the physical aspect into the soul, so that what otherwise works in the body's substances works in the form of hallucinations, you administer potentized belladonna. In this instance, you relieve the body of an activity by shifting it to the soul. This is what we encounter in the usual macroscopic effects of belladonna, although, as I said at the beginning of this lecture, there they are confused and pervaded with illusions. If you push people to remain in the waking up stage instead of moving on to full wakefulness, you kill them. People are always in danger of losing their lives when they wake up, but they wake up so quickly that this danger is overcome. There are interesting connections here between a so-called normal process, one contained within normal limits, and a process that becomes abnormal as soon as it transcends normal limits. These are processes that the physicians of antiquity repeatedly attempted to trace, or so it seems to me. When they spoke of engendering the homunculus, this more or less meant that in the clairvoyance they still possessed, they could see something like the antimony phantom. The proteinizing forces that oppose antimony appeared to them, projected out of their own being, in the external formative process they carried out in their laboratories as antimony forces developed. They externalized a force that normally remains within the human organism. They saw the homunculus appear in the course of the process in which antimony assumes its various forms. In the process that was played out there, they saw the homunculus. The end of lecture 19.